And our first question is, how many Hebrew children were killed by Pharaoh when he ordered them to be killed, those two and under? Were they drowned by God, or did God stop it? I have no knowledge. I don't know anything in inspired record that would give a number on this. And my understanding is that, no, God didn't stop it. They were killed, except Moses. Moses was saved, but most of the children, and there was a great cry in the land because of this. Why do we see miracles like in the Old Testament, New Testament? Example, God answers by stones, saying yes or no. Paul with the cloth touched, and so forth and so on. So when you ask questions like this, you're step back and ask the question, are miracles still happening? What would you say is the greatest miracle? A miracle, the working of God's power to bring about a change that is not natural to the natural order of things. Is that fair to say what a miracle is? The use of divine power to bring about a change or outcome that is not in harmony with the natural order of things. Yes, no, miracle, yes, okay. So that would be every human who is reborn and recreated in the image of Christ, and you see a new heart and right spirit, and you see people who were living sinful lives now leading righteous lives, you're seeing miracles every day. That is the ultimate miracle. And the reason we don't necessarily see the physical miracles is because the types of physical miracles that people look for are generally for the weak in faith. And as your faith increases, the need for those types of miracles decreases. And if you think about Gideon and his fleece, he needed the miracle of the fleece because he had strong faith, or his faith needed encouraging. And you look through the scriptures, there's lots of miracles done typically through the strong in faith. You mentioned Paul. Those miracles were not for Paul. Paul had a health problem. He never got a miracle. Those miracles were not for his benefit. His faith was such he did not need a miracle for him to stay faithful. Those miracles were for the new converts to help solidify them in their faith. And so the same thing with the speaking in tongues. It wasn't for the apostles that the speaking in tongues was done. It was for the advancement of the gospel and all the people who were about to hear the gospel that the miracle was done. The miracle Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace, while it benefited them, it did. They didn't need it. They said to Nebuchadnezzar, we know that our God can deliver us from the fire, but even if he doesn't, we're not going to bow the knee. They didn't need a miracle to stay faithful. They were going to be faithful. That miracle was not for their faithfulness. That miracle was because of their faithfulness to reach Nebuchadnezzar, who had yet no faith. And so why do we not see miracles today? One reason is because potentially we're looking in the wrong place. We're not looking for the hearts and minds of people being converted. Two, we often don't recognize that the physical miracles are most of the time done for the weak in faith. And three, that as the Holy Spirit is withdrawn and Satan gets more freedom to act on the earth, there's going to be more and more counterfeit miracles by Satan's supernatural powers, like a serpent talking in Eden, or Jannes and Jambres throwing down their rods that turn into snakes like Moses did. And you'll see counterfeit miracles happening. And God does not win by miraculous signs and wonders. God wins by the truth. And you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. So we're going to be advancing the truth, which wins people to trust. And in that trust, they have a miraculous rebirth experience, and they're transformed. And that's the miracle we're to be looking for. I was doing a word study on the Hebrew Kippur, and found that, like Yom Kippur, Day of Atonement, and found that the word is similar to another word, Kippuru, meaning purifier, cleanse impurities. Many other scholars on the subject have pointed out a similar thing. Anyway, how would you go about bringing this up to someone who thinks the Day of Atonement is a judicial sense? I think the similarities over the, support the medical. The similarities support the medical view of the cleansing. Well, I wouldn't probably start with the linguistics. I would start, when I have a conversation with somebody, is how do you understand God's law functions? And then I would draw the contrast between made-up rules that require external enforcement and design laws that the Creator builds. And I would make the very clear distinction that God builds reality, creatures can't, and therefore his laws are the laws that sustain reality. And they give examples of how when you break his design laws, it always causes damage, whether it's physical damage from the laws of health or damage to one's heart, mind, and soul by breaking the moral laws. And then what's the problem that sin caused? A legal problem or a condition of being problem? And then what is the plan of salvation? To do something with a legal adjustment or to actually restore us to harmony with the Creator and then bring it. So this is the way I roll with it. And then you can bring in these, what I would say, ancillary points that actually confirm, because the whole story is consistent. It's all about healing, reconciliation. Even the word at one meant bringing us back into unity when we are reconciled to God. And that's what's actually happening in the ceremony. There's a person who is writing something about somebody at another organization. I don't know those circumstances. I'm not going to talk about those publicly. But they do ask the question, basically citing this person as an example of somebody who supposedly, reportedly, doesn't have assurance of salvation. And they ask the question, why is this seems so prevalent in so many churches that people don't seem to have assurance of salvation? And it's the root. I mean, the root problem. Because people don't actually trust God. Seriously, across the landscape of Christianity, doesn't matter your denomination, most people, if you actually, and I've done this with Christians across the land. Now, there are people who trust God in all denominations, but you will find many in all denominations who don't. And then you start picking down why. There's root reasons they don't. What many Christians trust in is not God. They trust in the payment Jesus is going to make in their behalf. They trust in the blood sacrifice. They trust in their records being erased. They trust in the robe of righteousness. They trust an intercessor to plead to the Father. They don't trust God. They trust all the mechanics that their legal penal justice system has told them are being done to God to prevent God from killing them, because they can't trust him directly because law requires him to kill them. So the root of this is misunderstanding the nature and problem of sin as being a legal problem. Because they misunderstand God's law, and thus they can misconstrue God as the source of pain and suffering that he has to legally inflict. And so assurance of salvation comes when you recognize that sin is actually a condition of being, and that God is always for us, never against us, and he's done everything within his power to provide us remedy to win us back to trust and heal us. And then when people come to see God as Jesus revealed him to be, trust is restored. And then their assurance is, I put my life in the Lord's hands, and I'm going to keep my appointments with him. And the outcome is now assured. I trust him. In your blog, The Truth About Hell, 9221, you equate the manner of death of Nadab and Abihu to the manner of death of the wicked in the end. Does this mean that your teachings of consuming fire of God's presence parentheses, in which the righteous are able to live and function, simultaneously consumes, or, in other words, miraculously, physically, yet humanely kills the wicked, like Nadab and Abihu? No, not exactly. You've conflated a couple of things. The stories in the Bible, like Nadab and Abihu, are object lessons, but Nadab and Abihu did not die second death. Nadab, even though that fire came out, and it is a revelation of the fires of infinite truth and love. It was not the fires of combustion, because their clothes were not burned and the tent did not burn down. This is not the fires of, it is the fires of truth and love, and they died before the Lord. So it's an object lesson, but they did not die second death. They simply went to sleep. And so it is not exactly and the fire is not harmful, as you've described. The righteous stand in the fire. So the fire is not what causes death. What causes death is unremoved sin from the heart and mind of the sinner. That's what causes death. Sin, when full grown, brings forth death, James chapter 1. The wages of sin is death, Romans chapter 6. Those who sow to the carnal nature, from that nature reap destruction, Galatians 6:8. And so, no, the fire is life-giving. And what happens is, those who have solidified themselves in rebellion, fear, selfishness, when they stand in that fire, they have truth experienced in who they are, and they choose to end their own life. The fire does not end their life. Just like Judas chose to go out and hang himself. That's a good lesson. That was still first death too. But they choose basically to surrender back, because if they don't surrender back, they spend eternity in the fires of love and truth, and they hate love and truth. It torments them. They don't want to be tormented, but God doesn't take their life from them. They surrender it back, like Jesus, our substitute on the cross, surrendered his life into his Father's hands. But he trusted his Father. They don't trust the Father. They just want to flee from him. So what do you think as the reason why God did not tell Job about his discussion with Satan, granting him permission to do all the calamity? If we humans, if we human are created equal, why would God allow Satan to cause the death of Job's children and servants except Job? What lessons should Job learn? And so forth and so on. First off, all the people who've died from any cause through human history are asleep, first death. It's not the death that's punishment for sin. That's the end of the 1,000 years after the great judgment. So they're all asleep. So why did God allow that? I encourage you to go on to our website and get our pamphlet, Job in the Last Days, where we go through 7 lessons about what this book was for and what was revealed in that. And after reading that, if you still have questions, then send those questions back in. What lesson was God trying to teach, or mindset was God trying to instill in the early believers with the deaths of Ananias and Sapphira? On the surface, it appears to simply instill fear of the Holy Spirit for committing a sinful act. Other examples of harshness and so forth and so on. It's very straightforward. It's very simple. If you understand design law and you read what actually happened. It doesn't say God killed them. Nowhere does the text say God killed them. It says they died. That's what happened. They died. And why did they die? Peter confronts Ananias. How have you allowed Satan to enter your heart such that you have lied to the Holy Spirit? And then he died. That's what happens. Read the text. Acts 5. So what's being revealed by that? How does design law work? It's an object lesson. You have a terminal condition, cancer, bilateral pneumonia, HIV infection, doesn't matter. Pick a terminal condition. And you go to the doctor who has a remedy that will cure you. But you cheat and you lie. You tell the doctor you've been taking it when you haven't been. You throw the medicine over the counter and you lie about, can you get well if you cheat and lie with your doctor? Yes or no?
No.
That's all that's going on here. You cheat and lie with the source of wellness. And guess what? You die. It's just a simple, straightforward object lesson. Nobody gets well from sin by cheating and lying with the Holy Spirit. That's all. It's all designed to show. And again, Ananias went to sleep. He'll be raised in one of 2 resurrections. What originally, what was the sin in heaven really about? I'm going to read to you a little section out of the book Desire of Ages because I agree with this assessment. It's in, and I was just reading it this week. And so when you asked this question came in, it was like, I just read this, and I agree with this author's perspective, describing how things were in heaven and how it broke out. And this is just, you can read it more widely, and it makes a much better case if you read the whole chapter, but this is just one paragraph in one sentence. It says, and it's talking about God's character of love and how things work in God's kingdom of love and the living law of love. And it goes, but turning from all lesser representations, we behold in God in Jesus. Look into Jesus. Looking to Jesus, we see that it is the glory of our God to give. I do nothing of myself, said Christ. The living Father has sent me, and I live by the Father. I seek not mine own glory, but the glory of him who sent me. In these words is set forth the great principle that is the law of life for the universe. All things Christ received from God, but he took to give. So in the heavenly courts, in the ministry for all created beings, through the beloved Son, the Father's life flows out to all, and through the Son it returns in praise and joyous service, a tide of love to the great source of all. And thus, through Christ, the circuit of beneficence is complete, the circle of love, representing the character of the great giver, the law of life. In heaven itself, this law was broken. Sin originated in self-seeking. So that's my view. Selfishness, anti-love. That's the original sin. And then Satan spread that to other hearts by lies about God, and lies believed break the circle of love and trust. All right, guys, that was the last question. Y'all have a good week.
Okay, thank you.